I'd like to welcome you to our program. This is going to be a very empowering hour. First, the latest on health and healing. If you've never heard of Fistin, F-I-S-E-T-I-N, it is known as the longevity nutrient. There's an interesting piece by Zach White from Life Extension, done some meticulous research, and I'm going to share why this is so important. Also, have you heard me talk about tocotrienols? T-O-C-O-T-R-I-E-N-O-L-S, tocotrienols. It's a little-known nutrient, but it has amazing benefits for your cardiovascular system, your circulation, and some. There's new research from Thomas Rosenthal. I'll share that with you also. Every day I recommend people take pycnogenol, P-Y-C-N-O-G-E-N-O-L, pycnogenol. Nodge and all. And it also is a longevity nutrient. Sarah Brighton has some information, and I will share some of that as well. But for me today, the most important part of the program is two interviews. One, Chris Hedges interviews Noam Chomsky. That is a rare combination of intellect, social consciousness, and the ability to see things as they are, not to edit them, and just to share why we need to know this. So Chris Hedges interviewing Noam Chomsky today, plus one of the more in-depth thinkers on the planet, and Brendan O'Neill. He's talking about the woke generation and what they've got wrong, which is just about everything. So this is our program today. And, of course, we always start with the latest on health and healing. And I want to start with understanding what you can do to start bringing some of these anti-aging nutrients and foods and juices and lifestyle changes into your day-to-day life so that we can all benefit. Now, when it comes to this particular one, it's been known for a while. In fact, it's been at least 30 years that we've known that we can use this particular nutrient to slow the aging process, at least the pathological part of the aging process. Aging normally doesn't carry with it any of the feared diseases and ailments like arthritis, muscle loss, dementia. That comes from premature aging by doing the wrong things. So we're going to talk about a plant extract called Fistin, F-I-S-E-T-I-N. Now, you're going to be able to get that when you eat strawberries and apples and other plants, and it has a lot to do with what we call the senolytic action, meaning clearing away dysfunctional, sentient, or the cells that have defects in them or are dead. It's like a house cleaner. Goes in like a vacuum inside the cell. Cleans out the debris. That allows the cell to function better and to renew itself. It also protects your brain in various ways from neurodegenerative diseases. So if you had ALS, Parkinson's, multiple sclerosis, dementia and Alzheimer's, definitely important there as well. It also improves the outcomes in people with stroke. So if you've had a stroke, you definitely want to be using this. And it helps with prevent malignant changes in cells, cancer, helps fight obesity and type 2 diabetes. And in fact, there are a lot of human trials that have shown its ability to be used in important ways. In fact, for the first time, researchers develop the use of it as a supplement, and it's about 25 times higher in absorption, thus enabling the fistin to distribute throughout your body. So that's what you need to know about this. Why do we believe that it extends our lifespan? Because it does. How well your cells age will determine whether or not there's dysfunction or non-dysfunction at the cellular level. When you have french fries and potato chips and pretzels and hot dogs, hamburgers, all of those, alcohol, smoking, they all cause disruption of your cell. In the process doing that, and that's really bad, the cells become prematurely aged. And when you have prematurely aged cells, they're going to hang around the body longer. They're going to be toxic. They're going to degrade nearby cells. And they incite what is called chronic inflammation. And that causes all kinds of systemic damage. So cellular senescence has become a major area of anti-aging research. And a lot of clinical studies indicate that compounds called senolytics remove senescent cells, meaning aged and damaged cells. And so this is one of the ways that fistin was effective at removing these senescent cells, both in cell culture and in animals. So because it turns off inflammation, and because it is helping reduce oxidative damage, it allows the cells to live longer. So if you want to live a longer life, then make sure that you're having your strawberries in your diet, the flavonoids, onions, that's a good one. Apples are terrific, especially apple skins. And just add that to all the things you're going to do on a daily basis. In fact, it's been shown that a new foundation for the cells to work in, meaning cleaning out the debris, the senescent cells, boosts the bioavailability substantially. So make sure that you're getting fresh fruits and vegetables in your diet on a daily basis. That's important. So that's one thing that can help us, but there are other things that can help us as well. And the next thing are the tocotrienols. I first heard about the tocotrienols probably 30 years ago. And so if you're taking in vitamin E in its natural form, the different types, the most important are the alpha, beta, gamma, and delta vitamin E. Then those are called tocopherols, and they are terrific for you. They thin the blood, doing very much what an aspirin will do, but without any of the side effects. You're not going to bleed and die that you can from an aspirin. And also aspirins destroy vitamin B6, B12, folic acid, and vitamin C, which you need to keep your homocysteine levels down, because if you don't and the homocysteine level goes up, you increase your risk of death from a heart attack. So people taking an aspirin will diminish their chance of a stroke because it thins the blood, but you increase your risk of a heart attack. That makes no sense. When you take vitamin E, the tocopherols, that is helping the blood. It thins it out, but it also oxygenates, and that's very important. So along with the vitamin E, take your tocotrienols and take them as directed on the bottle. And it's been shown that they help with pancreatic cancer. They are they're extremely beneficial for helping the immune system, and that's important also. And research beyond cancer has shown that tocotrienols have a place in reducing the important risk factor for some of the most lethal chronic diseases. For example, tocotrienols have been found to promote new artery formation after a stroke, lower homocysteine levels, improve insulin sensitivity, protect vital brain circulatory system, and even prevent bone loss. In addition, tocotrienols have powerful lipid-lowering, anti-cancer, and neuroprotective properties. So that's why you got to take your tocotrienols every day. It can help your body. And it's very good for your cardiovascular system. I mean, extremely good. But a lot of people are concerned about, what do I do for cancer prevention? Well, we've gone through that, taking your broccoli, cauliflower, asparagus, Brussels sprouts, kale, watercress. Those are all good. Garlic, terrific. And but also, the tocotrienols help here too. In fact, tocotrienols impact several factors that tumors need for the development and growth. Tocotrienols have been shown to inhibit the growth of new blood vessels, to rapidly removing tumors and inhibiting growth and proliferation of cancer cells. And tocotrienols also sensitize cancer cells to the effects of standard chemotherapy. Astonishingly, it appears capable of combating cancer stem cells. You've heard me talk about many times. You got to get not just the tumor, you got to get the cancer stem cells. And it does this. Even those that are resistant to chemotherapy, this does it. Tocotrienol also triggers apoptosis, which is the programmed cell death of the cancer, meaning it, in effect, it has the tumor commit suicide. So just some of the things that we should be doing. And of course, it really benefits your cardiovascular system. It improves your lipid profiles, lowers your cholesterol, lowers the LDL, the bad cholesterol, reduces homocysteine, and it protects against ischemia. So by doing all that, it's allowing you to live a longer life and have healthier, very much healthier heart. It improves metabolic systems, therefore diabetics should take it. And again, it's very neuroprotective. It reduces oxidation, it reduces inflammation, it reduces toxicity in the brain cells. So that helps people with memory loss, dementia, Alzheimer's, Parkinson's, ALS. So you want a healthier brain? Take your tocotrienols, 200 milligrams of mixed tocotrienols every day. And it's been shown to work. Now, finally, on the level of what should we do to help ourselves every day? Well, how about pycnogenol? Pycnogenol. It's been around for a long time. There are hundreds of quality studies on it. It's also called the French maritime pine extract. And new studies show pycnogenol can prevent or reverse the oxidative damage that produces blood vessel disease, metabolic syndrome, diabetes, and neurodegenerative disorders. It does all that. It also shows promise in for people who have traumatic brain injury, skin problems, pain syndromes, even tinnitus. So those are some of the things that it does. And you don't have to take it at high doses. It works. So pycnogenol, yes. Tocotrienols, yes. Very important. And fistine, yes. Nutrients that you may not know a lot about, but boy, they are important for you. By the way, don't forget this Sunday at noon, a phenomenal time we're going to have deconstructing the crisis we're in today, challenging the great new reset that's not going to be great for us, and also where to live, the best places around the world, how to get a new career, which careers are going to be drying up, how do you get into a good intentional community, of which are over 1,000, all that will be explored and your questions answered. And you'll also be seeing a part of a new documentary at the same time. So we've got a lot to share with you this Sunday. Go to prn.fm or call our main number if you have any questions at 646-926-5422. But we have a wonderful special for you today. This is a Valentine's special. And we're going to give you a large jar of Power Berry Blast, a DVD, a documentary on hair care, a documentary on age is only a number. We're also going to give you a documentary on being a healthy woman and my multi-award-winning cookbook, Curing the Incurable Cookbook. We don't have a lot left in stock, and then we're gone forever on them. Plus, you're going to get a bar of our dark organic chocolate. How about that for a package? And a package of wonder it is. It's over $300 at retail. You're only paying, I believe, around, well, somewhere around $139. You're getting a huge discount. So if you want to take advantage of our Valentine special with the Powerberry Blast, the Hair Care Documentary, Age is Only a Number Documentary, Be a Healthy Woman Documentary, Curing the Incurable Cookbook, and the Dark Chocolate Bar, I want you to call this number. You can speak with Diane or Sandy or Neil, 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065. You're getting a huge discount, well north of 50% off, and it'll be shipped out immediately. And if you purchase just from Neil in our vitamin closet, in our corporate headquarters, call 646-926-5430. 646-926-5430. Again, this is our Valentine special. What a nice gift to give to the people in your life. What a nice gift to give to someone that wouldn't expect it, like your mom, your dad, your brothers and sisters, friends. Because everybody benefits from Power Berry Blast, because then you're getting all those berries in, mind you, we don't use the high heat. It's a powerful product. You're getting that into their system. You're helping with hair. Who doesn't need improvement with their hair? And aging, slowing down the aging process by watching Age is Only a Number and getting all the information and protocols. Being a Healthy Woman, the gigantic cookbook with all the pictures and the information and the detox, it's all in there. And plus the doctors talking about the ways they've helped almost every major disease, from cancer to heart disease to Parkinson's. It's all in the Curing the Incurable cookbook, which is a huge cookbook, beautiful cookbook. And look at all the gourmet vegan recipes and the juicing recipes, plus the dark chocolate. Who wouldn't want that package? What a nice gift to give someone. You know, I believe in giving gifts. My mother told me earlier in life, if you have a gift, give it. So I've spent my whole life giving the gifts that I have. I'd like to see that everyone gives a gift to someone that they care about, who's important in their lives. And we'll send it right to them. All right? So, and if you want us to write a little note to go with it, we have a person who has ability in our office, Jessica, to write that note. So we'll include a personalized note from you in there. Again, for our Valentine's special, and it'll go out today, call 877-627-5065, 877-627-5065, and you're getting a huge discount off its retail price. Okay? Now, we're going to go to Brendan O'Neill to hear what he has to say about our woke culture.
I wanted to sort of do a general thing with you. We've had a terrible year, clearly. I don't think we need to dwell on the obvious downsides of what we've been through, the lockdowns, the tears, the circuit breakers, the fire breakers, the destruction of the economy. And by the way, none of these measures seem to have worked. I'm not quite sure why we keep locking down when it's proved that all the other lockdowns didn't work. But that seems to be a function of this government's strange madness. But what worries me, Brendan, is under the radar of these huge changes to the way we've been living, you know, to this coronavirus crisis, which has been such a profound changer of our life, of our society, of our freedoms. Things have been happening almost under the radar. And I think that the most worrying thing that happened in this past year has been the rise and rise of wokery. What I want you to do is to look forward to this time next year. Do you think we'll cover a number of subjects, but do you think that wokery will have been defeated by this year, or at least that the sensible people of this country will have fought back against it?
That's the big question. I mean, I'm generally an optimist, but the reason I'm a little bit pessimistic about that particular issue is because in 2020, we were facing one of the most serious health crises of recent times. We thought that people would pull together and work together and you know, act as a society, act as a broader community. But in fact, what actually happened is that the divisive ideology of wokeness got worse and worse and worse. And it really exploded with the Black Lives Matter protests after the brutal killing of George Floyd. And what we had in the wake of those protests was the most hysterical display of wokeness we've ever had. We had people banning old comedy shows because they were supposedly offensive. We had people pulling down statues or putting graffiti on statues. We had museums like the British Museum, the British Library, and others basically self-flagellating themselves for their ancient links to slavery. I mean, it really was an orgy of self-hatred and wokeness and divisiveness. And if that can happen in 2020, when we're all meant to pull together in the face of a serious problem, then I'm pretty sure it could happen in 2021 too. So I'm a tiny bit worried, to be honest.
Yeah, I am too. But what I would like the government to do, let's give it a bit of a break. Over the past year, it has had some massive issues to deal with and to be preoccupied by. Given that perhaps the next year might not be quite so pressing in terms of coronavirus and certainly not in terms of getting the Brexit deal done, could this Tory administration raise its game and get to grips with this wokery problem? Because it should not have been a Conservative administration that allowed the rise and rise of this madness. As you say, I cannot. This used to be a serious country. It is not serious to start blaming people who live now for something that their ancestors did 350 years ago. It is not serious to throw statues into the sea because this person was a slave trader and rather a philanthropist, by the way, a person who helped Bristol insofar as he could. And it is not serious for our museums to start removing artifacts because they are linked to the slave trade. This is all the action of a shallow and mad country. We didn't used to be like this, and the Tories should not have let this happen to us. Can we retrieve our common sense and our seriousness?
We need to. I mean, that's the key point that needs to be made. I'm really surprised, as you say, that this happened under a Conservative government. To a certain extent, they allowed it to happen, or at least they weren't as forthright during the hysteria of wokeness over the past few months. They weren't as forthright as they might have been in defending British traditions, defending British history, defending British values, and sending a signal that we will not tolerate this screeching, hysterical, censorious culture that really comes from the kind of media elites and radical leftists and other sections of the kind of political class. That's the signal they should have sent. And I think what the Conservative Party doesn't seem to realise is that they would make themselves very popular. Yes. If they were to criticise this craziness, if they were to criticise the excesses of gender fluidity, the idea that you can click your fingers and change sex, if they were to criticise the notion that all of British history is just a litany of crimes, one horror after another, if they were to criticise the idea that Britain is a horrible, racist country and no one should take pride in it, if they were to criticise those things, those ideas, they would win a lot of support among particularly Red Wall voters, those former Labour voters who gave their support to the Tory party this year, in December. They would win the support of all of those people and many others too. So they need some bravery. They need some backbone. They need to start facing down these divisive ideologies and putting Britain back on the straight and narrow.
Is it possible for the government to ban from our schools the teaching of critical race theory? This nonsense about telling little kids who happen to be white that although they don't think they're racist and although all their best friends are BAME people, they really are racist. And of course, this goes up to organisations like the BBC, which is currently telling all of its employees who are white that they are the beneficiaries of white privilege. This is a fact, according to the diversity director, June Sarpong, who gets $75,000 a year for doing 3 days a week. She has talked only 2 days ago about the problem of elite white males. Even working class white people have got a much better deal than the BAME community. And again, this preaching of racism, of prejudice, telling us all that you didn't think you were prejudiced, but you are. If it seeps into, if it infests an organisation like the BBC, and while we're at it, might as well throw the National Trust in with that and our museums, we are in trouble. We need to get rid of this nonsense, don't we? We need to get the BBC not to have a creative diversity director. We need the BBC not to come up with 55 pages of nonsense about why the BBC isn't diverse enough. I mean, it just so happens the BBC is incredibly undiverse, but the BBC should be concentrating on making good programmes that people want to watch, not polishing its own halo about its own wonderfulness. Same goes for the National Trust. Just keep the houses nice so we can go and the stately homes so we can go and visit them. Don't bother, you know, been sort of sainting yourself, becoming saints about your magnificent lack of racism and getting rid of it. It's nonsense. We need to do something about this, don't we?
Absolutely. And we have to do something about critical race theory, especially in schools. It is a toxic ideology because it is dividing kids. You know, we live, there was a racism problem in this country a few decades ago, and I'm sure, of course, racism still exists, but the story of this country is that it has become one of the least racist countries in the world. Black and white people and people from all backgrounds mix and work and educate themselves together every single day. And now what we have are these new elites going into schools, going into universities, going into public institutions and saying, listen, white people, you're all racist, even if you think you're not. Listen, black people, you're all victims and everyone hates you and everything else. And it's dividing people. It's saying that blacks and whites will never truly understand each other because their experiences are too different. That is a divisive, hyper-racial ideology. And someone like June Sarpong actually sums up the problem with this culture, because here's a woman, an accomplished broadcaster who now works at the BBC, who gets paid, as you say, $75,000 a year for 3 days a week of work. And she is saying to even to working class white people and poor white people, she is saying, even you have privilege. So this is a woman who lives a very nice life on a wage that is paid for by us. Poor white people face criminal sanction if they don't pay their TV license and they own a TV. They pay her wages. She turns around and says to them, you are privileged and you need to educate yourselves. This is like a new form of feudalism. We have this feudalistic class of people who are looking down their noses at ordinary people, calling them privileged, calling them racist, calling them backward, essentially. This can't go on. I think it is so insulting and so demeaning. We need a country that pulls together as part of a national project rather than this divisive politics of identity.
And now let's hear from State of the American Empire with Chris Hedges and Noam Chomsky.
Professor Noam Chomsky, the pioneering linguist, prolific author of numerous seminal political works, including The Fateful Triangle, Manufacturing Consent, Failed States and Requiem for the American Dream, and America's most important intellectual, along with Marv Waterstone, Professor Emeritus at the University of Arizona, explore the failures and inherent cruelties spawned by global capitalism in their new book, Consequences of Capitalism, Manufacturing Discontent and Resistance. They argue that the rampant, endless wars, both hot and cold, the unchecked militarism these conflicts spawn, along with a raging ecocide, unparalleled levels of global wealth and income inequality are fueling system breakdown and the rise of repressive and authoritarian regimes that revoke basic liberties, rule through fear and coercion, and speak in the toxic rhetoric of hate and violence. This descent into a species of corporate totalitarianism and the ecocide that accompanies it, threatening the human species and most other species with extinction, will only be halted, they argue, by radically reorganizing human societies, politically, economically, and culturally. Joining me to discuss where we are and where we must go is Professor Noam Chomsky. So in the book, you talk, there's a lot of great stuff in there. You talk about, you know, how we perceive reality. And I want you to discuss that how is our cultivated perception of reality a form of social control? Of course, you refer to Gramsci.
Well, we're seeing pretty dramatic examples of it right now. There's a huge part of the population which sees is deeply committed to an alternative reality, which has no basis in fact and is entirely the opposite of all evidence, but they cling to it religiously. And in fact, you've seen plenty of it in your experience in the media. They have a reality of their own. So they have, that's the reality of the liberal intellectual elite, which is that the United States is always trying to do good things, but makes mistakes here and there. And we have to correct these mistakes, but everything is fundamentally wonderful. So this assault on the Capitol shows the power of American democracy, because we didn't collapse into a fascist state. Very much like the reaction after Watergate, odes to the magnificence of the democratic system when right after the demonstration of corruption and evasion in the effort to conceal what happened. For example, the Watergate, striking in Watergate, that the only serious charges against Nixon were eliminated. They were introduced by Robert Drynan, Jesuit priest, representative from Massachusetts, who insisted that they include the bombing of Cambodia, which was one of the most horrendous acts of the period, certainly of the Nixon administration. But that was cut off, and what was left was tax on the Democratic Party headquarters, things like that. Bad, but nothing like the serious crimes. And that enabled us to show that American democracy and its magnificence had triumphed. And we're seeing a kind of a replica of that now. There's some really serious ills, bipartisan, incidentally, although the Republicans have gone off the spectrum. But those are not being discussed. What's being discussed is a crazed mob, as if they came out of nowhere. They didn't come out of nowhere.
In your classic book that you wrote with Ed Herman, Manufacturing Consent, you talk about that process by which the dominant narrative is kind of inculcated within the public. And yet we've seen now with the rise of digital media, there's a bifurcation within the media. There are kind of two dominant narratives. People are now siloed within their own particular prejudices, or their own particular worldview is catered to, and of course their proclivities are monitored and fed back to them. I wonder if you could just go back and look at that work. It was the great, great work in terms of dissecting the media, and talk about now in this age of digital media how that dominant narrative is essentially ingested within the public to get people to ultimately call for their own enslavement.
Well, remember that the book, substantially Ed Herman's, the late Ed Herman's, why I insisted that his name be first on our joint publication, contrary to our usual alphabetic ordering. But the main framework is his. But it was focused on the sources of news and information, the major media. Now, the social media are a new phenomenon, and they're very significant, but they don't affect the source of information. Twitter doesn't have reporters in Beirut seeing what's happening. What they do is take the we still have the same major information sources, and I think they're pretty much like they were in the past, maybe a little more open than in the past, because a lot of young people who went through the activism of the 60s and the aftermath have since moved into media, which has given them a slightly different and more open complexion. But the social media are over and above that. They take the picture of the world that's fed to them by the major media, and as you say, they bifurcate it, much in the way that talk radio has done for many years. I used to listen to it constantly, and it's an alternative world where you hear nothing else but the extreme right, and plenty of people are caught up into it. Now we have that exaggerated with the social media maximizing that effect. And of course, it's has increased irrationality on all sides. If you only have your own views echoed back to you, you're not going to think. You should be reading and thinking much more broadly.
You've often written about how the very words and phrases that are fed to us essentially exclude other ways of seeing the world. For example, the war on terror, which is a kind of tautology. You can't have a war on terror. Talk a little bit about how the constant repetition of certain words and phrases limit our capacity to see reality.
Well, take war on terror. The United States is one of the major terrorist forces in the world, but the war on terror doesn't apply. In fact, I started writing on terrorism back around the early 80s when Ronald Reagan came in. As you recall, the struggle against terrorism was going to be the centerpiece of our policy. No more talk about human rights. Now the grand issue is the war on terror, the plague of the modern terrorism, the plague of the modern age, and so on. The terrorism he was talking about was resistance to U.S. terrorism in Central America. That was the prime case of it, and also South Africa. Remember that for the Reagan administration, to the very end, Mandela's African National Congress was one of the more notorious terrorist groups in the world. Mandela himself was not permitted into the United States till many years after, decades after apartheid ended, took a special congressional resolution to allow him in because he was a leading terrorist. So the concept of terrorism in the early Reagan years was interestingly inverted. The terrorists were not terrorists. The people who were not terrorists are terrorists. And it was, when I began writing about this, I started using the U.S. Code for its definition of terror and the U.S. Army manuals. And if you look at their definitions, what the Reagan administration was doing was the peak of terrorism by our own definitions. In fact, the World Court took the same, accepted the same conclusion. The United States is the only country to have been brought before the World Court and to have been condemned for international terrorism. The words that they used were unlawful use of force, which is international terrorism. Here goes back to your point, how did the U.S. react to that? Almost nobody knows about it. Actually, the New York Times, I don't recall whether you were on the Times in those days, but the New York Times had an editorial saying we can dismiss the judgment of the court because it's a hostile forum. Why is it a hostile forum? Because it condemned the United States. So since it's a hostile forum, who cares what they say? And that was the end of the court judgment condemning the U.S. for terrorism. You look over the media discussion, same right until today. So, for example, the U.S. ran an extraordinary terrorist campaign against Cuba for years. The idea was to bring the terrors of the earth to Cuba, as it was described by Arthur Schlesinger, the associate of John F. Kennedy, who launched the campaign. How's that described in the United States? Some silly actions by the CIA trying to, burn Castro's beard, little hanky-pank. It wasn't that. It was a serious terrorist war. It almost led to the destruction of the world. It was one of the main factors that led to the Cuba Missile Crisis. Kennedy himself had authorized in August 1962 escalation of the terrorist activities in Cuba with the intent of leading to an uprising in October, which would be followed by an American invasion. October 1962, okay? It was no joke. Do you ever see any discussion of it? No, it's just war on terror. When Bush relaunched the war on terror, not launched, relaunched in 2001, it was those terrorists out there we have to go out after, not our own terrorist acts. And this is a brilliant example of how internalized understanding. It's not even propaganda. I think it's internalized. You can't, just as you can't get the Republican mobs to admit that the election was lost, you can't get liberal American intellectuals to recognize that the United States is a leading terror state. It's just not us. I mean, maybe some mistakes, you know, maybe some bad guys, but not our consistent activities. What defines us is our pursuit of democracy. And it's very interesting how that's dealt with.
I'm going to stop you there. I'm going to stop you there, Noam. I just have to take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our conversation with Professor Noam Chomsky about the state of the American empire. Welcome back. We continue our conversation with Professor Noam Chomsky about the state of the American empire. You were talking about that kind of mythology of a transcendent purpose. And in the book, you reference Antonio Gramsci, and you talk about the difference between organic and traditional intellectuals. Can you lay out that distinction for us?
Well, for Gramsci, an organic intellectual was an intellectual who embedded himself in activist social movements and tried to help use whatever special talents or privileges they had to carry forward the popular efforts for carrying the world forward in a better direction. Those are organic intellectuals, dissidents, we call them in other countries. Then there are the traditional intellectuals who are what are called stenographers for power often. Actually, Henry Kissinger, who was a perfect model, described them once. He said, the goal of the political intellectual is to articulate the ideas and concerns of people in power in a more proper and careful way. That's the job of the intellectual. Serve power. So if Nixon hands to me, Henry Kissinger, an order to bomb Cambodia and destroy everything, my job as a intellectual, responsible intellectual, is to present it to the head of the Air Force with the words, massive bombing campaign against Cambodia, anything that moves against anything that flies against anything that moves. In other words, total genocide. That's my duty as a responsible intellectual, to articulate the views and intentions of the people in power, in this case, to call for genocide. Okay, that's one view of the intellectual. There's another view, the ones we honor in enemy countries, but condemn in our own country. It's what McGeorge Bundy, National Security Advisor for Kennedy and Johnson, called the wild men in the wings, the ones who go beyond saying we made a tactical error, you didn't understand something, and actually look into the motives and goals that we were pursuing. Wild men in the wings. We have to remove them from the body politic, from the intellectual world, not publish what they say, demonize, condemn them, and so on. In our own country, when it's in an enemy country, we idolize them as marvelous dissidents who are courageously standing up to power. This goes all the way back in history, as far as you can go. Go back to Greece. Who was it who had to drink the hemlock? The man who was corrupting the youth of Athens by asking too many questions. We don't want that around, not in a free democracy like Athens. And pretty much the same up to the present.
You reference Orwell about how popular ideas can be silenced, inconvenient facts kept in the dark without official censorship. Can you take us through how that process works?
That's George Orwell. An interesting article which was suppressed. It was the intended introduction to his book Animal Farm. Animal Farm, of course, everybody's read Animal Farm. In the introduction, which is called Literary Censorship in England, something like that, he says to the British, where the book was to appear, he says, this, of course, is satire on the totalitarian enemy, but the British shouldn't feel so self-righteous because it's a free country. And in a free country, exactly what you quoted, unwanted ideas can be suppressed without the use of force. And then he gave just a few sentences of explanation. One was, the press is owned by wealthy men who do not want certain ideas to be expressed. The other, he said, is basically a good education. You've gone to Oxford, Cambridge, you just have instilled into you the understanding that there are certain things it wouldn't do to say, just like other kinds of behavior are unacceptable. These things it wouldn't do to say, things like what we've been talking about. It's a free country, so you're not thrown in prison for saying them. You're just marginalized and cut out in one or another way. I don't have to tell you, you're more familiar than I am. But these are the methods by which, without the use of force, you can ensure beliefs of the most crazy kind without exception. Let me give you another example. Take Bernie Sanders. If you read the left liberal critics in the mainstream press, they say Sanders has really good ideas, but they're too radical for the American people. We just can't go that far. What are his leading ideas? The main one is universal health care. Too radical for the American people. Can you think of a country in the world that doesn't have it? I mean, this is such an insult against the American people. It says, you're so backward and reactionary that you can't have what Mexico has and what France has and what Brazil has because you're so backward. And nobody questions this, actually not nobody. The one of the best correspondents for the London Financial Times, Rana Farahar, associate editor, had a piece in which she said that if Bernie Sanders was in Germany, he could be running on the Christian Democrat Party program, the right-wing party, because what he's calling for, universal health care, free higher education, is just taken for granted by conservative parties in Europe. But here it's too radical for Americans. Almost nobody points that out. We could do case after case like this. Take Cuba, for example, which we mentioned before. The United States right now is not carrying out terrorist wars against Cuba, but it has Cuba under a very tight blockade, which is extreme and is opposed by the entire world. When it comes up in the General Assembly every year, universally condemned. Israel votes with the United States, but it has to. Does that matter to anybody? No. They're terrorists, just like Mandela. They support terrorism. They do all kind of bad. They have human rights violations. which is true. In fact, on Cuba, they're the worst human rights violations in the hemisphere. In the southeast corner, a place called Guantanamo, which we stole from Cuba at gunpoint and refused to give back to them. The human rights violations there are the worst in the Western, some of the worst in the Western world. Do you ever hear that? These are
true. I just want to close by talking about militarism. Karl Liebknecht called militarism the enemy from within. There's no check anymore. It's not like the 1960s where the liberal wing of the Democratic Party might challenge a weapon system. It's the endless wars which have been, you know, aside from all of the suffering that has caused, $7 trillion wasted. Can you talk a little bit about that cancer of militarism?
Well, we just saw we have the most wonderful military system in the world to defend America. And if you look at the oath of office that the chief of staff, chairman of the Joint Chiefs, takes, it's to defend America against enemies, foreign and domestic. So we have this magnificent military to defend us against domestic enemies. Was it able to defend the Capitol a couple of days on January 6th? Not that I noticed. But you're right, no Democrat will dare to, virtually none, Bernie Sanders did, a couple of others, to oppose a $750 billion military budget. We should never use the word defense. It's a military budget, it has nothing to do with defense. This was an Orwellism, I think it was 1947, all throughout its history. The United States had a ministry of war. Yes, because we were always at war. The United States is one of those rare countries that's been at war almost every day since its founding. The first war was the invasion of the Indian nations, the destruction of the indigenous population. That was one of the main reasons for the Revolutionary War, was to free the colonists to invade the rest of what is now the territorial country. So first came a century of wars of aggression against the Indian nations, virtual extermination, invasion of Mexico, taking over half of it, expanding into the rest of the world. Hardly a day without war. In 1947, when the new Orwellism was imposed, the War Department was changed, and its name was changed to Defense Department. Anyone with eyes open knew there isn't going to be any more defense. There's just going to be war. Yes, so it's the Defense Department. We have a defense budget. Doesn't defend us against domestic enemies. In fact, it doesn't defend us against anybody. It's for war, attack, aggression. No opposition. And it's not just the War Department. One of the most remarkable things that Trump has done was to dismantle the entire arms control regime. This has been slowly put in place. Much of it goes back to Eisenhower, the Open Skies Treaty. Some of it is Reagan, INF Treaty, all dismantled. It has had some positive effect in reducing the threat of terminal war. And remember, a nuclear war is a terminal war. We're done, it's finished. Has reduced the threat. So let's throw it to the winds. Almost nobody talks about it. Doesn't come up in the presidential campaign, and the hardly a word about it. And the destruction of the arms control regime is accompanied with bipartisan support for development of new, far more dangerous weapons, which increase the threat of terminal nuclear destruction. That's defense, okay?
Coupled with ecocide, of course.
Thank you all for listening today. I look forward to hearing from you this Sunday when you're on the webinar with me. For those of you who want to know which are the new professions to go into, where the best places to live, We have all this new information to share with you. We've spent months working on this. All right? Go to prn.fm for more information on that. Have a nice day, everyone.
And when I go away, I know my heart can stay with my love. It's understood. It's in the hands of my love.